This is Radio Influence.
He got him in the white trunks. He hurt him.
That's beautiful. Oh, God. That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the top. Wow. And here's a submission. And it's all over. It's nice. All over. First round knockout.
Big
Rich
one
Franklin
punch
changed his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
Welcome to the March 14th edition of the MMA Report podcast on Radio Influence. Coming up on this week's podcast, Daniel and I will be discussing the article I wrote last week titled, What Should We Think About Mirko Krokop Being Booked for Bellator 200? I will expand on my thoughts on the whole Krokop and USADA story and get Daniel's take on the entire situation. Then we will discuss the potential of Nick Newell to get into the UFC following his win this past Friday night at LFA 35. Also on this week's podcast, we are going to let you hear comments that Frank Mir made on his podcast last week following UFC 222 about Megan Anderson. We'll take a look back at last weekend's MMA and tell you which fighters impressed us and preview this weekend's UFC Fight Night card in London. Along with that, I will have two interviews for you as I chat with LFA Bantamweight Champion Ricky Simone and CES MMA Welterweight Champion Chris Curtis. Ricky will be making his next title defense next Friday night, and Chris will be defending his title at the beginning of next month. Now, Daniel, let's get this podcast started by discussing something we briefly touched on last week's podcast, and that's Mirko Krokop being booked to fight at Bellator 200 in May in London. Last week on the podcast, I stated how I was really unsure how I felt. After recording last week's show, I ended up doing some research on the story, talking to various people, and I ended up writing an article. You know, and there's several takeaways I have on this story. I think my biggest takeaway in reality is the fact of I believe the MMA media cares 1,000 times more about this story than a majority of the MMA fan base.
Definitely, they do. But that's not the media's job, I think. I think the media's job is to care about the story because like they are supposed to be the watchdog of the sport. Are they not, Jason? Like it's if I'm a fan – I do not care about, you know, in baseball, for example, what Ryan Braun did a couple years ago when it comes to performance enhancing drugs. I like the entertainment product. So I wouldn't say that the media is at fault for covering this story like crazy. I think they are very much they should just because it's like that is certainly a way of bending the rules if you get a 2-year suspension. And you go and you fight in Japan, like, immediately afterwards.
You know, and one of the parts about the story, and I'm sure pretty much all of our listeners know, you know, the backstory of this conversation. Now, if you are listening to this podcast, you're not aware of the backstory, I explain it in detail on my article on themmareport.com. Briefly just saying this suspension that was handed down in 2015 after Krokop admitted to use and attempted to use and possession of human growth hormone. And of course, once that suspension was handed down, he gets up being suspended and then he retires, but then of course comes out of retirement, fights it in Ryzen. And, you know, before we kind of get into a lot of this subject, I want to play a comment from Scott Coker. He was in London last week and he talked with Jim Edwards of MMA NYTT.com. And I want to play that comment. And here's what Scott Coker had to say about the entire Krokop situation with USADA.
You know, I could get into the whole thing about that, but here's the thing is like, look, Mirko fights in Ryzen in Japan.
Yep.
You know, and USADA has a relationship with UFC, and they're in Japan all the time. Why didn't they go after him 2 years ago when he started fighting for Ryzen? Why is it a coincidence that he just comes? This pops up because he's fighting for Bellator and I have 200th event. And I mean, to me, it's like if you want to take action, you should have took action a long time ago. Because to me, honestly, we booked him. We didn't even know there's any issues, right? You know, it's like, you know, he's already fighting, so we thought he was able to fight. And you know, listen, USADA works with the UFC.
Sure.
Right. They're doing their own thing. So good for, you know, go do it. But, you know, I just feel like the timing of it is a little bit, you know,
yeah,
it's a little bit like questionable, right? Because at the end of the day, if you really wanted to enforce it, you should enforce it 2 years ago when Mirko fought in Japan.
And once again, that was from Scott Coker talking to Jim Edwards of MMANYTT.com. Daniel, first off, Scott Coker is 1,000% correct. Where was USADA when Mirko Krokop fought in Ryzen?
Well, you're right that there was not a presence, and now there is. And I love the fact that he's kind of getting into the fact of he's getting his hands dirty with those comments, you know, saying the UFC may be the ones pulling the strings. That's not what he said verbatim, but that's kind of what I got off of those comments. And that's kind of rare for Scott Coker to go there. He usually plays it pretty conservative with what he says and doesn't say. But my counter to you is that I don't know if I'm Bellator, and then the case I'm making is, why aren't you holding us to the same standard you hold Ryzen? I don't believe Ryzen, as great as it is, and I know we have a super fan that likes to listen to us, and I do think it's a good promotion. This is still a completely different world than the world that Bellator and the UFC are playing in. I just think you look at Ryzen, and this is a fight promotion that puts on Gabby Garcia fights against grandmothers. So why didn't USADA make a fuss about this? Because clearly USADA has zero influence on what transpires in Ryzen. They have much more influence over what transpires in Bellator. Not enough influence to actually create any change, but they have enough influence to make things difficult from a PR standpoint for a couple of weeks for Scott Coker. So that would be my counter to that point that Scott is bringing up. Just that I think when you have Krokop fight in Japan for USADA, there really isn't much they can do about it. Now when it comes to for USADA, if now they go ahead, Krokop is fighting in England, and they go ahead and try and make it more difficult for him to fight in America, that's when I do think you begin to draw questions about this is a different now, because that wasn't a discussion point when he was in Ryzen, his ability to fight in America after the 2 year suspension, because it wasn't a discussion point, period. I don't mind criticizing Bellator for putting this fight on, but I do mind changing that position once he signs a contract with the UFC's number one competitor.
Here's why I do not criticize Bellator. Bellator does not license fighters. They can want to make a fight, but at the end of the day, they don't have to. And one of the things that you have to give credit to Bellator on, when they first started their international expansion, they self-regulated their events. Their director of regulatory affairs handled it. Scott Coker, to his credit, realized that, you know what, we need to bring in a third party. We need to have a executive director run this. And that is when they brought in Mike Mazzulli, the Mohegan Tribe Department for Athletic Regulations, who's also the president of the ABC. You know, I think that, you know, so at the end of the day, if you want to cast any blame at somebody, to me, I think you have to be looking at Mike Mazzulli and not Bellator, because at the end of the day, Mike Mazzulli is the one that will potentially give Krokop a license. And let me just note this. Krokop is in the process of getting a license with the Mohegan Tribe Department of Athletic Regulations. Mike Mazzulli is going to be flying to Croatia personally to drug test Mirko Krokop. And the Mohegan Tribe has probably some of the toughest pre-fight medical drug testing there is in the business. Krokop will have to go through all of that. So if he goes through all the medical testing and he passes his out of competition drug test, he will then get licensed for a fight. So that is something to mention. Someone had asked me if there was a chance that Krokop could not get licensed for this fight.
Yeah, I like that you brought up Mazzulli, because to me, if you are looking at who is taking the biggest loss here reputation wise, it's probably him, just because I saw a quote out there that he had, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he said something along the lines of the Krokop issues were, quote, like in the past or whatever. Is that the quote that I saw?
There was something along the lines. Now let's notice, It has been 2 years and 3 months since Krokop was handed that suspension. And if you remember, it wasn't Krokop was not suspended due to a positive test.
Yeah.
He was tested because he was honest.
That's the crazy part. Although here's the two things about that. Okay, so yeah, he told them he was taking the growth hormone. He did not fail the test. He got suspended for 2 years. I don't know what I think about this because I don't really have much empathy. Because he still cheated.
I wrote in my article. Essentially, he did ignore the USADA suspension. But here's the thing, majority of me believes that the reason USADA is getting in front of this is A, because the president of the ABC is going to potentially regulate a fight with someone they suspended 2 years and 3 months ago. Now, I have to believe, and this is just my gut feeling, I think USADA wants to be held in the same standard as a regulator. But they're not a regulator. They're a drug testing administrator. That's what they are. You know, yes, their suspensions are placed in the MMA database, but they are color-coded where they are not considered regulatory body suspensions. They are only there for educational purposes only. And this was voted on by the ABC last July at their annual meeting. You know, I think part of one of the questions I have with Krokop is, so you give him this 2 year suspension. So this was November of 2015. He fights in September of 2016. So at that time, does his suspension become frozen? How does it become unfrozen? And the other aspect of this is when he took these fights, he was not a member of the UFC roster. So legally speaking, USADA really can't do anything. And B, why, you know, if I'm Krokop, why should he be just doing what USADA wants when they have no jurisdiction over him?
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at it from Krokop's perspective, I mean, his job is to go out there and put money in his pocket. I mean, that's his whole thing. So I understand it from that. I understand it from Bellator's perspective. I think one thing you touched on is I hadn't really thought about this when it happened, but USADA really doesn't reward admission of guilt because getting that two-year suspension is the same thing as if he had failed that test. So I would look into changing that just because I think you want to reward guilt. Because then there's like reward honesty, excuse me. Just because like there's no incentive for a fighter to be honest. So my suggestion would be Krokop. If somebody did exactly what Krokop did, you give him a one-year suspension instead of a two-year suspension. Just that's my suggestion. And what I would say is you don't – though the biggest issue here when it comes to letting things go regarding Krokop is that this sets a very bad precedent where you have a guy who gets suspended for 2 years and he immediately basically fights in Japan. I mean he gets like five fights in. Granted, four of those happen in a two-day period, but he gets several fights in during his quote-unquote suspension. That's a bad precedent. Where you just have every guy who gets suspended goes to Japan and gets them checks. So what I would say is you could also throw some egg on the face of USADA for not having the proper institutions to tackle this problem. The standard of what should happen should have been in place before somebody did what Krokop just did, and maybe they can do it moving forward. So that they needed to have had some type of policy that you mentioned where potentially a suspension is frozen or something of that nature if a guy goes and takes a fight in another country or with another promotion that isn't using USADA and they don't respect USADA suspension. That's what USADA should look into doing is before something actually happens, they should have a set guidelines on how to enforce their rules. Because their case does begin to unravel when they are making these decisions after events have transpired. You kind of get what I mean by that? Like, mm-hmm. Like they have kind of screwed themselves by not being prepared for this situation. And now they look like they they've made their way to the commission octagon wearing UFC underwear. And so that is the tough one for them. But to me, like, again, there is also egg on the face of Crow Cup just because, like, this guy did not honor his suspension. I understand why he wouldn't want to honor his suspension, because he wants to buy a golden jet ski, but it is a bit of a bad look.
This is a landmark decision by Mike Mazzulli at the end of the day. You know, I do wonder. I think, you know, and you mentioned a little bit earlier about, you know, maybe indirectly Scott Coker mentioning, you know, could the UFC be behind this? I think that you can't help but think that. And I've posed this question to various people in the industry, and I'll pose this one to you, Daniel. If the promotion that Crow Cop was fighting for, let's just say it was in London, it was not named Bellator, and this is an event not regulated by the ABC president, would USADA care?
Yeah, let's say this is a Bama fight.
Great example.
Like, no, I don't think so. And the tough one is, how do you determine whether or not USADA cares because of the UFC's influence, or because Bellator is just a company that has more eyeballs on it? Because when I look at USADA, I look at which companies do I care about? Or no, excuse me. When I just look at an MMA fan's perspective, which companies do I care about? The top two is unquestionably UFC and Bellator. And then I feel like there's a really big gap between everything else. So that's the counter, is maybe it's not the UFC. It's just the fact that Bellator is supposed to be the number two promotion in America. And they are a promotion that has a lot higher standard, a lot higher eyeballs. So that is difficult to prove the difference between, or the motive between whether or not you saw it as tackling this. But to answer your question, if this was a fight in Bama or any other promotion and Crow Cop was in it, this wouldn't be a discussion point in the media, and this wouldn't be something you saw it as pushing against. I feel very confident in saying that. Because it is a Bellator fight, that is why it is a discussion.
You know, I think this is a great debate to have. You know, one of the things, and, you know, when you look at USADA, and look, I think overall USADA has done a great thing. I've always said the one thing I've never liked about this drug testing policy is the fact of it was not collectively bargained. It was essentially, here are the rules, sign or you can't fight. And also, I kind of wonder, can USADA just change the rules as they go? I think that's a question. That's why I would always like this drug testing policy better if it was collectively bargained and fighters actually had a say. You know, I do believe that the reason that USADA has a problem is because Mike Mazzulli is regulating it. But I'll say this. If I'm Bellator, and I would love to see third-party drug testing in Bellator, I think it would be great. But if I'm Scott Coker, why the hell would I want that? We have seen what it's done to the UFC. And also, financially speaking, I don't think it makes any sense for Bellator financially.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, all these decisions are made for financial reasons. Like, the reason why the UFC has good drug testing is largely due to the fact that there is a real financial negative to being known as a dirty sport. That could really hurt your bottom line, especially in a sport like combat sports where you'll have serious damage. And also, simply put, like, these commissions aren't going to regulate those fights. So for Bellator, because the UFC already does such a good job with drug testing, I think if you're the number two promotion in a sport, you're going to be protected by the umbrella and the reputation that the UFC may have with USADA. So financially, you really don't have to worry about getting coded as a dirty promotion, because these dirty things, like these labels of being dirty or guys being on drugs, really envelops an entire sport and not so much a specific promotion. So Bellator can thank the UFC for, I think, doing the USADA deal, because I do think they have done that. You aren't going to have people not watch Bellator because they perceive them as being dirty. I think those problems happen when the entire sport, maybe much like cycling, for example, is deemed to be filled with juicers and performance enhancers. So financially, what's the incentive? There isn't one. It costs more money. and for Bellator, going for it is likely going to cost you some of your bigger draw fighters. Now, morally and ethically, is there a case? Absolutely. But morals and ethics, I mean, let's not pretend like that is very valued in the fight game. It isn't.
I mean, look, this was a situation I knew would happen at some point. It just was a matter of when did it take it. But, you know, when I was getting ready to write this piece that I wrote, I wanted to hear what MMA fans had to say. And there was a couple of tweets I ended up putting in my article. And one of the tweets I want to read to you came from Brandon, at Brandon Be Better, where he said, quote, USADA also is not a governing body. Therefore, their testing is at best a suggestion. Those not affiliated with USADA shouldn't really take their suggestions, in my opinion. Kind of hard to disagree with Brandon.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is the thing, and I wrote but Daniel, I wrote this in my article. If this was a year ago, I don't think Mike Mazzulli licensed Krokop. I think part of the reason why, and, you know, I'm sure Mike has done his due diligence. I'm sure he's talked to 1,000 people about the situation. It's been 2 years and 3 months of a 2-year suspension. Now, I understand you could sit there and say, hey, he fought overseas. And that's why I am conflicted on it. And I've told people that. I said, it's tough for me to really have a stance on this because at the end of the day, he did ignore the suspension. But I don't think Mike Mazzulli would be the only executive director that would give Krokop a license right now.
Yeah, he wouldn't be the only one. Now, all of them would not do it, but he wouldn't be the only one. And I am very much in line with you in that I think Krokop should be allowed to fight in England, but I am just concerned about the precedent being set, just because, like, once again, John Jones, maybe he should just be fighting in Japan for the next 4 years or whatever, and making big money fights, and he can return back to America or England after his suspension's over. What I worry about is the precedent being set, and for USADA, the issue for them is they really came across, I think, in this whole ordeal as less powerful than I think they were perceived to be.
Oh, I think this is like a worst case scenario if you're USADA in the UFC. You know, it's very interesting to see how this one plays out. I don't, you know, because then I look at this and I say, you know, USADA is not a regulatory body. It is sitting there and having a battle with the president of the ABC, what's best for them? If I were in the leadership of USADA, I'd book a flight to Hartford, Connecticut. I'd drive up to Uncastleville. And I would have a meeting with Mike Mazzulli and see, is there a mutual agreement they can come to at some point?
Yeah, I think that direct communication is what needs to happen for them, just because I don't think fighting this without that, fighting this in the media, fighting this with messages not directly to one another, is going to be a lose-lose. When you have a USADA and a regulation body kind of in a pissing match, that's a bad deal for both involved, and it just never works. It's much like a social media fight. There is never a winner, and you just have two losers.
I think USADA has more to lose than Mike Mazzulli.
They do. They certainly do.
But it puts a hole in their suspensions.
Mm-hmm. But it also makes Mike Mazzulli kind of look like he's in Bellator's pocket a little bit, just a little bit, not a lot of it, but just a little bit.
I would disagree with that.
You would. I mean, I don't know. He just comes and he regulates their fights, and he's like, Krokop, you're good. Go fight. Chuck Liddell, Tito Ortiz. He hasn't regulated that fight yet, but you know, I mean, maybe that's the guy I go to if I'm Bellator.
I don't think that's where they're going. And I will tell you, I've talked to some people that they don't think there's much to Liddell and Bellator, and that Coker's not going to go that route.
Proud of him.
I hope Scott says no. I really do. I mean, but at the end of the day, you know, I understand why people want to rail on Bellator, but they don't license the fighters. I mean, that's the thing. One thing I keep going to, and I know there are people out there that are USADA homers, and USADA can do no wrong. And look, I think USADA does a lot of great things. But in a situation like this, I feel like we need some clarity on, is there anything, you know, when Krokop was handed his suspension, I got to imagine there was paperwork that was sent to Krokop. Was there anything in that paperwork that stated what happens if he takes a fight within those 2 years? And what happens to those terms of that agreement if you're no longer a UFC contracted fighter?
Yeah. I don't know if that's in there.
Yeah, and I mean, I would assume
there isn't. I would assume the first isn't in there.
I've asked around. I haven't been able to find that the answer to that question. I mean, it's I'll tell you, but in kind of a related topic of this, I saw David Rickles post the poster for Bellator 200. So it had the six fighters on the top three fights. The top two fighters on the poster were Krokop and Nelson.
That's crazy.
Bellator has not come out and said who the main event of that fight card is. Scott Coker, in that interview with Jim Edwards, did basically mention that how the decision has been made, and he'll be talking to his TV partners about it. But that poster makes it look like that Krokop and Nelson's main event, which, once again, I don't understand why you make that the main event.
Well, I mean, I guess they're the bigger stars than Musasi and Carvalho.
But here's, I guess you got to wonder, does Bellator at all regret booking Krokop Nelson?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. I mean, look, they did put Mike Mazzulli in a tough position, and he's making a landmark decision. And it's going to be, you know, look, as I said, I'm still conflicted on how to feel. You know, in one way, I sit there, and we'll kind of wrap it up on this for this topic is, you know, it has been 2 years and 3 months, but he did take fights in Ryzen under his suspension. So I see both sides.
Yeah, I would just say that my general takeaway is this shows the fact there was pretty big hole in the process of USADA, and what they need to do going forward is set a policy in order to have institutions to handle these situations before they transpire, not after. You can't, to me, it's just a bad look to adjudicate something and change things after you see, a fighter sign up Bellator. That is a bad look. So what they need to do is understand there was a bit of a hiccup here. There's a bit of a wiggle around their suspensions, and they need to put things in writing and make it incredibly public as to what the consequences are for taking a fight during your suspension in another country.
Have a feeling this is not going to be the last time we talk about this subject.
No, I'm sure Fight Week of UFC 200 is going
to... Yeah, I'm sure when we get to that last podcast in May, it'll be a topic as well. But we do want to go back to last Friday night, LFA 35, of course, headlined by the returning Nick Newell, who had his first fight since October of 2015. He gets a submission win over Sonny Luque. And, of course, all the topic after this fight was the fact of, you know, could a UFC offer come? And let's start off with questions we got from Chris McCann at ChrisMcCann924 on Twitter. He says, what is there to discuss about Newell and the UFC? He wins one regional fight, and every media member clamors for UFC to sign him. Was a memo sent out to do this, or did one person do it and everyone just followed? I don't mean this to sound confrontational. I like you and Daniel. How bad would the PR be if he gets beat down on the big stage? We saw what Gaethje did, and did anyone top 15 hurts him badly? Sponsors and networks bidding would run from this visual like their house was on fire. Imagine a casual fan flips on Fox and he's taking ground and pound, and it's a lose-lose fight for the UFC to take, for a fighter to take in the UFC. I was at that fight, and great question, by the way, there from Chris, and I actually responded to Chris saying this was something I was going to bring up anyway, but glad that, he asked the question. I was at World Series of Fighting, what was that, 11? It was a July 4th weekend, Daytona Beach, where it was an afternoon card on NBC, and that was the first time that WSOF it was on big NBC. And, you know, that was kind of the question leading into this. What happens if, you know, you have a congenital amputee is getting beat up badly? What happens if some, you know, non-sports MMA fan turns on and sees this? After that event was over, months and months after the event would happen, I had someone basically tell me that NBC got calls about this and got calls from people wondering why this fight was happening. And I think, you know, overall for the UFC, if there is any consideration right now to sign Nick Newell, I think the first phone call has got to be to Eric Shanks and Fox Sports.
That might be it. Or you just don't call them and you just put him on Fight Pass.
But it's not, but you can't have him on Fight Pass forever.
Yeah, but then you put him on pay per view.
At and some point,
never put him on TV. never put him on TV.
But at some point,
you're probably right.
At some point, he would be there. I mean, look, Nick Newell is a 14-1 mixed martial artist. He has won three in a row. His only loss is against a guy that I think arguably we could say is a top five lightweight.
Yeah.
In Justin Gaethje. Now, is there that marketable win on the regional scene? Eric Reynolds is probably the most marketable win you can look at. You know, things haven't gone well for Eric recently, but when you think about when he fought Eric, Eric was a guy that, you know, could have been a win or two away from getting into the UFC when they fought in the XFC. If Nick Newell, you know, in terms of why the media is hammering on this, I think part of it, Daniel, and I know we talked about it before we started doing the show, how much of that is because there was no UFC or Bellator last weekend?
I think it's a big reason why. I don't know if this would be a discussion point if there was a UFC event or a Bellator event this past weekend. I think that's the whole reason. I think when you look at sports media in any way, they've got to put articles out every day. They've got to produce content every day or else, I mean, you can't just go like, today we aren't talking about anything. See you tomorrow. That would be a bad look. Now, Nick Newell was, by God, what a beautiful gift to the MMA media he was. Because the Nick Newell topic, which has been had before, back before he got that fight with Gaethje, which looking back on the fact that he was put in an octagon with Justin Gaethje, it's like, holy crap, that was a bad idea. Like a really bad, like one of the worst ideas we've ever had in the sport. That was a big jump up in competition, even as good as Eric Reynolds is. Like Justin Gaethje, we have now seen is like a top five lightweight and like is one of the most scariest men at 155 on the feet. But Nick Newell was a great blessing for the MMA media. Because I think what media in general love are these like debate topics where it can get kind of emotional. You can be like a guy that's you know has that would just be that would kill the sport if people saw him get beat down on TV. That would kill the sport, Jason. Like people love getting that emotional, and this allows people to get to that place. I don't think it would be that bad if he got like destroyed on TV. I think it would be like a little bad, like my grandmother might call Fox, Jason, but I think people would move on just because I think it would be different if we were living in a media age of like 20 years ago, 15 years ago. But because there is so much freaking content, I think it would like something really, really, really bad would have to happen in the octagon for something to have that negative of an effect. I think it might like be the story of Twitter for a day if worst case scenario Nick Newell gets just beat up pretty bad in a fight. But I don't think it would be as drastically negative as it would. But I would still have that discussion with Fox, as you mentioned, Jason. That is very important to have that relationship. And now here's one thing I will say. This isn't a lose-lose for UFC to sign Nick Newell. Because this is definitely a win-lose. You lose by obviously worst-case scenario happening. You win in that Nick Neal is very much someone with potential to draw eyeballs to your product. That is the win. Mm-hmm. As much as someone wants to see a congenital amputee, as much as no one wants to see a congenital amputee get beat up, they just as much want to see a congenital amputee beat the hell out of someone. Like there is a great enjoyment of the story of watching Nick Neal go out there and tap someone out. And there people will watch your product because of him. That's why we are talking about Nick Neal and not any other prospect, is because in a time where there are very few fighters under a UFC contract that move the needle, Nick Neal and the story he can tell definitely does. So that's the win. And I'm someone that believes that the way we over-dramatize negatives in general, and I don't think the negative would be a true tragedy for the promotion. I mean, they're already doing not very great ratings, so.
I mean, look, it would increase ratings. Maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't. Now, if Nick Newell was not a congenital amputee and he had two full arms, there's no question he'd be in the UFC.
Yeah.
No, well, I mean, he's 14-1. I mean, go find me a 14-1 fighter that is not potentially, you know, on the UFC radar or in the UFC. It's, you know, we talked about it last week. Juan Archuleta, kind of a rare case, a guy that entered Bellator 17-1. You typically don't see that in MMA. Usually they're already on a show like a Bellator or a UFC at that moment. You know what, you know, and you know, as I was looking at Nick's resume, you know, and we mentioned there's not, you know, a ton of marketable wins there, but part of me goes, I wonder how many fighters have said no to a Nick Newell fight.
It's important to color in the resume, because when you lay it out, how many 14-1 fighters would it be in the UFC? It's like most of them would. And by the way, a lot of them have similar resumes when it comes to competition level. Like, there's a lot of shoddy records, but to color in the resume, it's important to note, like, his best victory is Eric Reynolds. His second best victory might be, like, I don't know, Tom Marcellino back in World Series of Fighting, something like that. And then it's like a big drop off. Like, his win that he just got in his first fight in a couple of years was over a 36-year-old who's 8-7. And that's definitely in the top half of his wins, by the way. So it's important to color in his 14-1 record in saying that the competition isn't very good. But then you bring up the point that, like, unfortunately for Nick, you got to think that several solid fighters did not take a fight with him, because losing to him would not be a great look.
No, it would not be a great look for them. You know, I mean, but we should note on this fact, the UFC's had a chance to sign Nick Newell in the past, and they didn't. So why should, you know, now, of course, it's different ownership of the UFC and now. So maybe the new ownership looks at this and says it. I mean, my gut says the UFC gives Nick a chance at some point, but I think he probably needs at least one more win.
Yeah, oh, I do too. I think he needs to. I think the problem with the UFC, or the problem with Nick Neal, is he just needs to prove himself that he can defend himself against good fighters. That's the one thing I want to see out of him. For him to get an opportunity in the UFC, or if he does get signed to the UFC, the tactic they need to go about it is giving him small upgrades and challenge after win after win after win. Do not make a big gap. Really get a feel for where his skill level is and try and put him in the best position to win. And do not put him in the cage with Justin Gaethje. You know, when he should come in, he should fight CM Punk. I think that would be a great fight.
The thing is, I think with Nick, and I think it's always going to be a question with him, is what happens if he can't get the fight on the ground?
He's probably going to lose against a solid striker, unless he's going up against a really bad striker, which there are a few of them.
Yeah, but if you put him in there against a wrestler who can stop that and keep the fight on the feet, I don't know if I like that matchup for him.
Oh, I probably don't, but there is a chance that he, against a guy who's like really not very good on the feet, I think if his wrestling does get stopped, there's a chance he's going to go out there and really employ a high volume output. But that's like a small minority of fighters that would probably lose that fight that way. So you're right. It's not, Nick Newell is a very strong fighter for the weight class. He really is. But he definitely, there is a large chunk of fighters in that division that will be able to defend the state defense.
Well, I mean, look, and the one thing you have to say about Nick Newell, he's a very talented fighter. You can't deny that. The guy is talented. But I ultimately think that, you know, whether it's a UFC or you know, even Bellator, you're having that conversation with your TV people. You're just not going out and signing Nick Newell without having that conversation.
Yeah, it's just not worth it to not have that conversation just because even though he will draw eyeballs, he's still not a super duper star. And I think it's worth having that conversation. I think it's worth being smart the way you had that conversation because there is value in signing Nick Newell for sure. And again, I think people are less squeamish than we give them credit for. And they can handle watching him get beat down. But the approach needs to be smart. And he does need to prove himself against a little bit better competition. It's been a very long time since he's fought. He just has one fight under his belt. He's got to go out there and beat guys with winning records that are better than 8-7 is what I will say.
Yeah, it would be interesting. You know, would maybe he takes a fight against, say, a Robert Whatley. Robert doesn't have a contract currently with LFA. I'm actually working on scheduling an interview with Rob, but you know maybe that's a fight that maybe you try to put together. But I mean, look, you know, fighting an organization like LFA, if he has another fight in LFA, it's going to be a tough fight. But you know, we'll see exactly what does take place here. Now, I do want to go back to last week's show a little bit where we talked about UFC 222. And, you know, we kind of talked about what's next for Chris Cyborg, and the UFC revealed a couple of days ago, officially, Amanda Nunes versus Raquel Pennington will take place at UFC 224 in Rio de Janeiro. I'm not quite sure if they've said it's actually the main event or not. If it's the main event, better have a good undercard to get people to buy that pay-per-view, because I don't see people going out of their way to see Nunez Pennington, even though it's a great fight, you know, but not going to be a pay-per-view that people ultimately truly get excited about. But, you know, that kind of leaves what's next for Chris. You know, maybe does she wait to see if Amanda gets through that, or maybe potentially it's Megan Anderson. And, you know, there's been so much rumors about Megan and why she ultimately didn't fight last year in the UFC. She has talked about its personal issues, hasn't gone into any details. We saw earlier this year, Chris Cyborg mentioned it was a visa issue, which was one of the rumors out there. And hat tip to one of our listeners who actually sent me this on social media and went back on Frank Mir's podcast and listened to this. I'm going to let you hear Frank Mir, who also mentions that it's a tourist visa issue for Megan Anderson.
Yeah, but, visas are just confusing as shit. I feel bad for people. Especially, you know what? That could be a whole show on itself. If you do shit the right way, it seems like it screws you.
Yeah.
You know, you do shit the wrong way here, you can go ahead and just work and do everything else.
But let's say if she is not completely legally cleared to work in America for whatever reason, she has to understand the UFC can't very well book a pay-per-view hope there's not going to be a paperwork problem.
She's here on a
problem.
Tourist visa only, you know.
Yeah.
You can't technically work, you know, and that's why when we go over, and the UFC is really good about that. Their production crew, you know, I mean, at least when I was there, I don't know the new people how well they handle it, but I mean, when we go and fight in Australia, Brazil, whatever, all those X's and O's are, you know, the I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, like, you know, you understand what you're going into so that we don't have these situations. So that's why she was pulled before him, because if there is some kind of issue where she marked down the wrong class of visa, and she's here, she can be here totally legal, but you can't work, you know, just, and that's a problem, you know, that, you know, you don't want to open up the door, and especially with Dana, you know, backing up more right-wing conservatives, all of a sudden it's like you yourself are going to have an illegal, you know, a work issue where you have an immigrant now, you know, a non-U.S. citizen who's working under the wrong visa, so the taxes issue gets thrown off, you become what everybody on that side is actually fighting against. It's like, well, wait a minute, so what's the difference between you and the guy who hires 20 Mexicans to go pick up the fruit, who, you know, they don't have proper work visas, you know?
And that was Frank Mir from his podcast, Phone Booth Fighting, which he does with Richard Hunter. That was from their episode right after UFC 222. So, you know, look, Megan has never publicly come out and said anything. You know, I've asked people and no one's talking, Daniel, first off. If it is a tourist visa issue, that leads, I think, a lot of questions. And I'll be honest, I'm not up to speed on how tourist visa works. It makes you wonder if that is the issue. And the UFC said, no, you got to get this situation corrected. I know she's been here in the United States for a couple of years. Kind of makes you wonder about, if she's just here on a tourist visa, how is she making money? I guess that's, and look, I don't really know the answer to that question, but, I thought that was interesting hearing Frank Mir now be the second fighter who's brought up about the issue is a visa with Megan.
Yeah. And just to note how you started it off, looks like Dana White's not really involved with the decision-making, or maybe he's not as much as possible, because it really sounded like we were getting Nunes-Cyborg after that Cyborg press conference, and we get Nunes-Pennington. Maybe we'll get Anderson versus Cyborg in Brazil, but to touch on the visa issue, it's real interesting what's happening here, because I think it's crazy how little is happening with the Megan Anderson situation, just because it has been out there for a long time that she has not fought. And I just wonder what the steps are for her, for the UFC, to put her in a position to fight. There isn't a whole lot of transparency. It's really hard to figure out. But if it is something like a tourist visa, I would hope that it becomes a bit more public, just because this is a really messy situation. And it would really suck for a fighter to find themselves in the exact same situation that Anderson does today, if that's what her situation is, just because information and could really save someone from going through this, because this looks like a total mess, a total absolute mess. And, had Anderson maybe gone about getting a work visa instead of a tourist visa, she would find herself challenging for the championship already, or in May. And so I really don't know, but this does look like a bad deal, where it's like she may find herself almost landlocked to America if she has real bad visa issues, just because I'm not a visa expert, but I'm pretty sure, like, if you kind of break the rules when it comes to a tourist visa, you're kind of screwed in some ways when it comes to your ability to go and change that into a work visa, or even leave the country and come back. So I don't know, man. This kind of sucks, because, I'm just a guy who likes to see people fight each other. But it's such a messy situation. And what's crazy is, like, how this hasn't happened more, almost.
Yeah, I mean, we saw Mirbek Taisimov. He's okay. Once again unable to get a visa to work here in the United States. I mean, that's the thing. You just can't – a fighter just can't come over to the U.S. and take a fight. They have to get a work visa. This is something that the UFC and Bellator goes through. We saw it a couple of years where, ultimately led to Bellator releasing Fyodor Kosmolaev because he could not get into the United States. And as I always say, I've seen some people talk about the Taisimov situation and whatnot and various times throughout the years. Ultimately, and I've always said this, if you can't get a visa to get in the United States, there's probably a reason why. I don't think the U.S. just says, oh, we don't want Mirbek Taisimov fighting in the United States. I have to imagine there's a legit reason.
Yeah, it seems like maybe the reason for Anderson is she just made a mistake originally, right? Like, an original mistake that it's not as, I don't know. I don't know what the reason is for Taisimov, but because you have – yeah, but you are right that, when there's smoke, there might be some fire there. That, like, who knows? Maybe he went out and he has stolen cereal from children. That's possible.
This is my thing with Megan and her management. She's now rep by Paradigm Sports Agency. I don't understand why they just didn't get out in front of this, instead of just constantly having people speculate on why she's not fighting.
Well, I will say in this country, in the current climate, I wouldn't advertise the fact that I'm having visa issues.
Touche.
I would say that is the one counter argument and I've already said I think transparency and information is important, and I think it's like, by God, you should not come to this country to fight unless the UFC or Bellator has signed you, because obviously every other promotion can't dot their I's and cross their T's, because how did she fight in Invicta? If Anderson was originally signed by the UFC and that was her first fight in America, I think this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I mean, she started fighting Invicta in 2015. I guess naturally that leads to a question of, did she You know, was she on a work visa? I mean, and I don't know the answer to the question. And once again, you know, we're just talking about what Frank Mir said on his podcast, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. You know, I can't sit here and say how visas work because I've never had to go through that process personally.
I don't think people who get visas can explain it, man. It just seems like it sucks. It seems like if you're getting a visa, it seems like, you know, how you wait in line in the DMV. It just seems like that, but like times a million. It's just a headache and confusing. And yeah, I don't know very many people. All I know is like people who I go to school with who are like athletes from foreign countries, and they have some type of visa. I don't know what it is, but yeah, it's some type of visa or basically like
it's like a school visa type thing,
something for education. Yeah, so I'm just like, hey, ladies or men, I'll marry you for you to stay here for money. So I don't actually do that, but I thought about it. So yeah, I don't know. Visas suck. I kind of want to see Megan Anderson fight. And this is like a good way to get her over because we're just always talking about Megan Anderson, and maybe she's not even that good. You know, I mean, she's probably good, but
well, I mean, if she did ultimately fight in the UFC, maybe actually the UFC would kind of develop legit 145 pound fighters. That's a crazy thought.
Yeah, yeah, she's the one you look at. It's like she could be the first ever non-cyborg featherweight fighter who fights solely at featherweight, and I want to see that. I really do. I want to see challengers in this division. Okay, question. Can Megan Anderson just go fight in Brazil, you think? But then I guess the issue would be getting back to America.
I don't know. I mean, she's – my understanding is she's under a UFC contract.
Maybe she should fight as like a masked luchador, so we just don't know her identity. I don't know. That just sucks. It's a real crappy situation. And I guess just to tag along to UFC 224, you know, I'm pretty sure Nunez Pennington's the main event. I don't really know what else you go to because you have three fights I see on the Wikipedia that are very clearly main card fights.
And God, that just does not.
I know.
That doesn't not. You know, look, it's a great women's fight. No question. Doesn't entice me to spend $65.
Well, what I would assume is like if you're going to main event UFC 224, you're going to put a Brazilian champion. But the only Brazilian champions currently is I'm going to just double check if she's Brazilian. She's not. Is Cyborg and Nunez. And so I guess like you could go – I don't know if I miss anybody. But I guess you could put Cyborg on top of that. But that would just be like a real spit in the face if you do a Cyborg fight the same night you do a Nunez fight and they're not fighting each other.
Yeah, it's you know, at the end of the day, just would love to see them develop that division, but I don't think it ever happens.
Yeah, probably not.
I think we're doing one-off fights.
Yeah. By the way, I don't think that undercard's getting stronger. I think when you have Belfort, Machida, Gaslam, Jacare, Nunez, Pennington, UFC already thought they've done their job and they'll put two random fights on the main card.
Yeah, but before we get to this weekend's UFC fight card, of course, still coming up, I'll have interviews with Ricky Simon and Chris Curtis. Last weekend's MMA, of course, most notably LFA 35, which we did talk about with Nick Newell. Co-main event, Vernon Lewis gets unanimous decision win. Charles Keeks III also gets a win. Somebody, you know, has now won four of his last five fights. His only loss was against Damon Jackson. Prior to that, he did get a submission win over Weston Wilson. Was there anything else that stuck out to you this past weekend, MMA?
Well, what stuck out to me is how many freaking events there were. There was a lot, and it's kind of impossible to get them all in. Like you had Bama, ONE Championship, ACB, M1 Challenge, Road FC. But the few fighters that I would point to that I really like what they did and where they're going in their careers, you have Brett Cooper at ACB. Now, this guy's like 25-13 now. And he knocked out Andre Santos in like 1:42 in round one. He's won like four of his last five, Cooper, most of those, or I think all of those in ACB, and three finishes in that streak. Another guy I'd point to, Shamil Zavarov. He's now 35-5-1. He just won a straight up unanimous decision over Hannes Torres. And dude is now won, I believe, six straight. And this is a 30-year-old from Russia. And then the last one would be in Bama. You had a unification welterweight championship main event between Alex Lahore and Terry Brazier, and Terry won the title or unified the title with a split decision win. And this is a guy, and Terry Brazier has been fighting for like 3 years. He has 8 straight victories, and this is a guy in this fight where it was a 3-round contest, and he used his wrestling to kind of win rounds 1 and 2. So those would be the 3 fighters I would point to, but the general theme is all these promotions saw that there was no UFC, there was no Bellator, so let's all run the card, and that's what they did.
Yeah, no, they should. Another name I would mention is Austin Lane, who's now 4-0, former NFL player who's made the transition to MMA. He got a win over Ben Rowland at Warfare MMA 18 this past weekend. Actually had a chance to speak to him prior to that matchup, and looking to get him maybe on the show next week, as it's a busy week for me, Daniel. I'm going over to Orlando for a couple of days at the end of this week to go with my nieces to Disney World. And then on Saturday morning, I'll be driving down to Hollywood, Florida, going to be calling the Shogun Fights card down there, headlined by Colton Smith, as he is going to be taking on Sean Bradley. Sean Bradley, a guy that if you're not familiar with, someone to pay attention to, 7-0. He is currently the CFFC welterweight champion. Looking forward to calling those fights from South Florida on Saturday.
That's exciting, man. Looking forward to it. I hope you would let us know who is and who is not virtually identical. Good little main event there, man. Bradley's a solid fighter. And you talk about a tough little test for him. Colton Smith is just that. I mean, Colton is a guy who you think of as like maybe one of the weaker Ultimate Fighter winners at the time, because like he won his season on the Ultimate Fighter. And I think like headed into the fight, he was like 2-1. And then after he won the season, he just promptly lost 3 in a row. And then it was out.
Hey, but what? Look at his losses. Robert Whittaker,
okay,
Michael Chiesa, and Carlos Diego Fajeya.
Well, Robert Whittaker is like one of the holy moly. That sucks that you fought him early on in your career, because yeah, that sucks. But look at what he's done since the exit by the UFC. Yeah, he's won 4 straight fights, and that's a good fight.
And he's not cutting down to 155. I was watching an interview he did with James Lynch where he, you know, basically talked about, you know, essentially saying it was a mistake to fight 155 pounds. He hasn't fought since April of 2016 as he was serving over in Afghanistan. So, you know, interested to see how that matchup against Sean Bradley. Co-main event of that fight card is going to be Caleb Williams versus Matt McCook. That's a catchweight matchup of 165 pounds, and a lot of local, you know, South Florida talent's gonna be on that fight card, so I'll be down there on Saturday. I'll get there early on Saturday morning, and look forward to calling those fights, and I'll let everyone know where they can watch those fights on Saturday. But right now, before we get into UFC Fight Night coming up this weekend, do want to let you hear the 2 interviews we have here on the podcast. Up first, you're going to hear from the LFA bantamweight champion Ricky Simon, as he is going to be defending his title next week on Access TV. Then you're going to hear from the CES MMA welterweight champion Chris Curtis, who defends his title on Friday night, April the 6th at the CES show. So going to let you hear those conversations, and then when we come back, myself and Daniel will preview this weekend's UFC Fight Night card in London. Ricky, I appreciate time. I was the other day, I was on Instagram, and you know, some of your photos came up here. When did the mullet come about?
Actually, I started growing that out for the Chico fight. So it's in full effect now. There's no hiding it now. Before it was a little subtle, people couldn't tell it's a mullet, but it's in full effect now.
So, you know, I think Mike Pyle has been the guy that's been known for the mullet in MMA. He got rid of his mullet. I mean, are now you just going all in? That's your thing?
Yeah, oh, perfect. Perfect timing. The new blood's coming up. I call it the Rolex of mullets. It's not your typical white trash mullet.
Now, what do your friends think about the hair style?
Oh, I get made fun of nonstop. I don't know. My parents were kind of like, they were kind of like strict on my hair growing up. I always had to get like short hair, and I never really got to decide what I did with it. So I've always kind of played around with it and changed my hairstyle over the last few years and since I've been fighting. Why not?
Yeah, I was kind of the same way. My parents always kind of had me stuck on the same hairstyle when I was growing up. Right? So I definitely know how I feel there. Of course, it's been a little bit of time since we saw that win over Chico. I know you've been in Hawaii. Are you now back here stateside?
No, today's my last full day. I take off tomorrow. So we have a hard sparring today, and I'm going to finish off with some hard rounds with the boys, the beach after that, and then got to take off tomorrow back home, get back in tune with my coaches over at Gracie Baja Portland.
Taking on Venetius here. Were you even familiar with him at all when you got this fight offer?
You know what? Not really, honestly, but I know he's good. I mean, I just hadn't really, I couldn't find any of his fights, you know, but I know he's fought in LFA. I know he's a killer, and you know, I know it's going to be a great fight.
What makes him the most dangerous?
He's dangerous everywhere. You know, he likes to throw hard, looping punches on his feet. He has good kicks, and you know, he's a black belt on the ground. So, he's well-rounded.
They always talk about, you know, why you like the matchup for yourself. So why do you like it?
I don't know if there's anything specific besides, like, I feel like I can break. Like I watch video and I like look for moments in the fight where the guy starts to break, and then that just you know, feeds me in training. And I see that already, like in some of his like fights in the second round, I see him start to kind of like give a little bit. And I got him for 5 rounds, so he better not be doing that in this fight.
When it's a 5-round fight, I mean, obviously, if so, you know, from going from a 3 to a 5, what's the difference in mentality?
It's just harder all around training for the fight. You know, you're doing 5-round, you know, circus, Shark Tank, sparring. But also, like, you never really know, like, what it is like to go 5 rounds until you do it, you know. And I went 5 rounds with an 8-time UFC vet, so I have some great experience. I know I can do it, and you know, I know I can push the pace for 5.
Was that the toughest fight of your career?
I'd have to say so, you know, with Chico's accolades and with it being 5 rounds and having to dig deep like that. I would say it was definitely the toughest fight of my career. And Chico's, he's one tough dude.
How would you say this fight's different than Chico fight?
I think Chico, you know, obviously more experienced. And I think Zani's, I don't know. I just think I'm gonna be able to dictate where the fight goes a little bit better with Zani, and I'm gonna be able to pick him apart a little more.
Well, you know, in dictating a fight, you know, obviously that's what you want. Has there ever been a time in your career where you walk into a fight and maybe you're like, I don't know if I'm gonna be able, if my opponent might be able to dictate the fight? And can that be a frustrating thing?
Going into that last fight, I knew Chico was good everywhere. So that, I mean, and I was excited to test myself against a veteran like him. But, you know, no, I know I have the skills to dictate where the fight goes. My MMA wrestling, I feel like it was very top level. And I've never not been able to dictate where the fight goes. If I want to keep the fight standing, it's standing. If I want to take him down, I take him down.
You know, and obviously a win here. I know you can't control what happens next. I mean, you can't dictate someone picking up the phone, calling your manager, and giving you a fight booking. But have you thought about, you know, kind of what the future holds for you?
Yeah, you know, if I'm being honest, I was a little surprised I didn't get picked up after that last win. You know, Chico's fought some of the best guys in the world. Fought for the world UFC world title. Beat Brad Pickett, you know. So I was a little surprised that I didn't get the call for that, because no one's ever really done that to Chico. But I like to stay active, and I don't want to like just sit on the belt. So you know, whatever comes up next, I just want to stay active, and I'm always ready.
Did you ever have that thought of like, why is it not coming after that fight?
Yeah, all the time. Like they just kept saying stay ready, so that's what I did. And I mean, I kind of gave up on trying to figure out what I need to do. I'm done playing the guessing game. I just decided to keep doing what works, which is beating people up.
You know, when you're in Hawaii, what do you miss most about being back up in the Northwest?
Probably my little brother, Frankie. I have a 9-year-old brother. He's like my best friend. Honestly, I mean, I'm all my family. I have a big family. In between workouts, I like go and hang out with him and when I have time and stuff. So honestly, he's the one I miss the most. But other than that, I mean, I'm in Hawaii training, you know, I'm fighting in the mornings, going to the beach and then fighting at night. So it's not too bad.
Now, if he wanted to be a fighter, would you try to talk him out of it?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a tough one. I don't want to like make him do anything. I want him to just find what he likes to do. So putting him in a bunch of different sports, but he loves wrestling already. So we'll see, I guess.
And what time's going to tell? Of course, this is the main event of LFA coming up here on Friday, March the 23rd. Ricky, man, as always, I appreciate time. Look forward to seeing your fight. And of course, let everyone know where they can follow you on social media.
Yeah, follow me on at Ricky Simone 135 on Twitter and Instagram. And thank you so much for having me on.
Chris, man, appreciate the time. For the CES fan, they've not seen you in a year, but you have had two title fights outside of CES. So besides those two fights, what's been going on with you?
What's up, man? It's just living the life, training. I went back home after December. Well, in December to, you know, spend some time with my kids and get to be dad again. So I was home for the holidays, just training and just living life. Like, you know, I'm out in California a lot. I'm there right now, actually. So I spend way too much time out here. So I got to go see my family and my kids. And now they got their presents. They got everything. They absorb dad's love. Now they're like, you can go away. We don't care. So back at camp.
But we mentioned the two fights that you've had, you know, since your last CES title defense. How do you assess your performance in those fights?
I felt good in both of them, man. Both two very different guys. The first one was Portland Pringle, grapple boxer. Like, felt really good. Like, just beat on him really for like four rounds until I could TKO him. And then the last guy, Peter Gashkar, was the number one ranked guy in Canada outside the major organization. And I just literally beat on this dude for like 25. I don't know what he was made of. Like, I don't know. There's some type of like Canadian super drugs in the water, but the kid wouldn't die. But I mean, like, that being said, like, man, I knocked this kid out like twice and just kept getting up. I'm like, oh my God, please stop. But I felt good in both. Took no damage in both, really. I felt good. Like, I feel really good. Everything's coming together really nicely. Like, you know, I'm always in condition. My wrestling is so much better being out here at Team Quest with these guys. You know, I've been doing my boxing back home at Sioux Center Golden Gloves with Coach Zero and Al. You know, Mike Stafford, who's Olympic coach, Adrian Broner's original coach. Rashid Warren's there. He's a world champion. Crosby, saying hi. Say hi, Crosby. Yeah. I'll get it. Go ahead. You know, Rashid Warren was a world champion. He's a little guy, but, like, you know, we're getting trained in advice from all these guys who are world champions and everything. Like, you can't not get better. Like, I feel great. Like, I'm excited.
When you have a fight where you're throwing everything at your opponent and he keeps coming back, can that be frustrating? Like, God, man, why can't I, you know, get this guy to quit?
I'm never frustrated. I'm more amused. Like, in my mind, everybody's like, oh, you know, maybe you lose heart. I never lose heart. I have no doubt that I can beat on you longer than you can be beat on. But on the flip side, I'm just more amused. Like, man, does your team not love you? Like, my team knows, like, you know, I'm all about being a fighter. But if I'm dying in the ring, like, I want to die like Apollo Creed, but not yet. I just turned 30. I've got some years before I... You know, once I get like Ken Shamrock's age, I'm okay doing the Apollo Creed in the ring. I'm only 30. Like, pull me out. Like, I'll be mad for like that night. Then I'd be like, okay, I was dying. The Peter Gashkar fight. You guys watch the highlight. I hit him with a hook and he goes out. Like, hits the ground face first. There's a front roll and he's just laying there on the ground for a second. He stands. He pops up like freaking like a vampire. Just stands straight up. I was like, oh my God, what is that? Rounds over though, and he's just like looking around confused, stumbles off into the corner, and I'm like, why wouldn't your corner stop this? They sent him back out and he fought two more rounds.
You know, in boxing there is the culture of save your fighter, hey, you know, live to fight another day. But MMA, it's not that. Why?
I mean, MMA, it's still young. Like, I mean, the actual sport of MMA, you could, like, cut out pancreation and all the crazy Greekness, is only, like, what, a few decades old? It's still MMA's that new kid on the playground, the new kid from in school who's still trying to prove himself, you know, prove how tough he is. So he may do some things that aren't quite intelligent. Like, I come from a boxing background. It's just like, nah, if he's going to die in the ring, you don't let him die. Like, it's not worth it. Like, no. So MMA guys want to prove how tough they are still. I think it's just part of the culture. It's still new. But I am not about that life.
Title defense coming up here on April the 6th, CES 49. Jason Norwood, 18-4 in his career, coming off a win against Carlo Prater. What makes him dangerous?
Well, if you ever look at the guy, he's just a rock of a human being. Like, he's such a big dude. I'm a pretty big 170, like, not tall, not, you know, not height-wise, but, like, stature. And this dude dwarfs me, and I don't even know how he possibly makes 170. Like, it's entirely insane. He's such a large human being. And he's, you know, he's a good wrestler. He's a really athletic guy, very explosive. For a big man, he's fast. He's got a fast speed on him for a big man. You got to watch out for that. And I'm a big guy, and I've got fast feet, and I shock people. So I'm aware of the trick of the fast big guy. So you just got to be careful, man. I know he's going to want to take me down. I know he's going to want to hold me up against the cage. So, I mean, the entire last 8 weeks of my life have been dealing with that, fighting off the cage, getting back up, stopping the takedown. So just a matter of not letting him grind me out. I'm a grinder myself, though, and I have to be. So we're going to see who can grind for 25 minutes.
The cliche you always hear is why someone likes a matchup for themselves. So why do you like this matchup for yourself?
They're paying me.
That's a good reason.
Yes. That's literally, like, I'm not even joking. Like, that's why my life. When you're like, you're going to fight this person, I'm like, what are you paying me? Like, the rest of it's, you know, I'll figure that out on fight night. The rest of it is, what are you paying me? Like, when am I being paid? And it is what it is, man. Like, I'm not, I don't know. I can't really say, like, oh, what I like about it, because I don't know what he's going to do. There's no, I have no idea what he's working on. I know what he's good at now, but I don't know what he's been working on. He hasn't fought in a year. We haven't fought in almost the same amount of time. He fought, like, a week after I did. We've been kind of both on the sidelines. I don't know what he's been doing since then. I don't know. So, I mean, I can't really know. So I'm just like, screw it. I'm not going to worry about it. They're paying me to come in and punch you, so that's what I'm going to do. I'll figure the rest out on fight night.
Will you at all troll his social media maybe to try to see what he's working on?
No, man. You know what's sad? I've known Jason Norwood for a while. I met him on the Fightmaster TV show. And he's just such a – I was kind of mad at Pat Sullivan, the CS matchmaker. I'm like, come on, you got me the one guy I can't be mean to. He's such a good dude. Like, I always find something to, like, I can troll somebody about, but I have nothing but respect for Jason Norwood. Like, he's a really good dude. I think he's still serving in the military. I follow him, you know, with Facebook friends. I follow him there. I've talked to him before. He's very, like, socially aware. Like, he's a great dad. I'm just like, I have nothing but respect for him. Like, well, I can't really, like, trash talk the guy. I like him. He's a really good dude. He's a good human. So sadly, I can keep to myself this fight camp, but, like, whatever. You know, we're doing a fight night. It'll be nothing but respect and two guys going at it. But they got me to one guy who's just like, you can't do anything to me because I'm I'm a pillar of humanity. I'm like, well, thanks, guys.
Is it tough to fight someone that you like?
No, I'll fight my mom if you pay me, but it's just like, I'm not going to talk trash about him.
You know, you get the win here. I mean, I think a lot of people would think naturally, the next step in your career would come. I mean, is that just something you just don't worry about because you can't control it?
I stopped caring. I really have. It's something. I don't want to be that guy, but it's something that, you know, I've been hearing for so long that we need to be in the UFC. We need to be in the UFC. And then I also hear, oh, it's right around the corner. It's right around the corner. I've been hearing that since I was 25. It's playing my life. I just don't care. Like, I'm going to finish it. You know, I'm just taking it year by year. I'm going to finish this year out. You know, if I don't feel any closer, then we'll go from there. But, like, I just don't care anymore. Like, I don't expect it. There are people fighting in the UFC right now who've done a fraction of what I have. You want to sound arrogant, but come on, like, you know, like, pull up the records. There are people who've done a fraction of what I have in the UFC right now. It's just, I don't know. I don't even care anymore. Like, I'm over it.
Any boxing matches lined up for yourself?
We're looking at some this summer, probably around June and whatnot. Just because my coaches back home wanted me to get through this fight and then have a little downtime. So looking at getting about probably 4 or 5 this summer.
And, of course, but first up, it is CES 49, where everyone's going to watch you live on Access TV. Chris, as always, I appreciate the time. Of course, let everyone know where they can follow you out on social media.
No problem at all, man. Thanks for having me. You guys can follow me on Facebook at Chris Curtis, or you can use my fight page. Please use my fight page because, like, it's getting confusing, all these random people I don't know. You can find me at Chris the Action Man Curtis on Facebook. You guys can find me on Twitter at TheActionMan513. You can also find me on Instagram at KingOfFists513.
Daniel, there was my conversations with Ricky Simon and Chris Curtis, two guys that if they successfully retain your titles, you got to think the UFC is definitely going to be on their radar. But let's get into this weekend's UFC Fight Night 127, of course, taking place from London, England. The Fight Pass prelims will start at 1:45 p.m. Eastern Time, 10:45 a.m. Pacific Time, and then your main card will start at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific Time. Main card, a four-fight main card, of course, headlined by Fabricio Werdum versus Alexander Volkov. Your co-main event, Jimmy Manoa versus Jan Blachowicz. Then you have Tom Dukinwah against Tarion Ware, and Leon Edwards versus Peter Sabata. This is a fight card that, there's not a lot of buzz around it, but, this is, when you look at the welterweight matchup, I don't know how much there really is to gain for Fabricio Werdum, but man, there is a lot to gain for Alexander Volkov.
Oh yeah, this would be a legitimizing victory for Volkov. I don't think he's going to be able to do it, but that's what everyone says before they make the leap. But I mean, Fabricio, over his last few fights and over being champion, has obviously established himself as like one of the best heavyweight fighters of all time, and currently a part of that elite tier of heavyweights that Volkov hasn't really come super duper close to getting at. But with the win here, he certainly would be a part of that discussion. I mean, this would be a victory where this sets up a platform for a potential title shot. And that's not something I think I would have imagined having watched Volkov's original run in Bellator. But he's going to have to fight a smart fight. He's going to have to hope that maybe Werdum has lost a step or makes a mistake or comes into the cage at the boomerang. But yeah, the way this sets up is pretty simple. You have a heavy favorite in Werdum going up against a younger guy in Volkov, a guy who may have some physical advantages when it comes to the reach and the height, and a guy who has a pretty sick nickname. I think, is it Drago? Is that his nickname?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's pretty sick. Who knows, dude? This card in England kind of sucks. Like, it's a three-fight card. Tom Dukinwah, Tarion Ware is okay, but to me, it's not as solid as Edwards and Peter Sabata. Everything else is really missed for me. But weird things happen in the dark in the UFC world. Whenever you have these fight cards that maybe don't have that much attention, that's when weird things happen. And maybe the weird thing will be a Volkov victory.
Yeah, I mean, and Volkov, it's been a pretty quiet rise for him in the UFC. 3-0 in the UFC. He's now won 5 in a row since losing those back-to-back fights against Tony Johnson and Chet Congo in the UFC, split decision win against Tim Johnson back in November of 2016. Then last year, decision win over Roy Nelson, then coming off a TKO win against Stefan Struve. And, I got to imagine for probably a lot of our listeners that, be a little double TV watching on Saturday, with the NCAA tournament and also this. And speaking of that, get this question from at Chris McCann 924. He says, can you ask Daniel, do I eat Buffalo Wild Wings 4 straight days starting Thursday for the NCAA tournament?
I don't understand why only 4 days in a row. You should eat wings every single day of March Madness. I understand. At the end of the day, you follow my diet plan, you will end up like in the hospital, or your cholesterol will be so damn high that you'll basically be Snoop Dogg but with cholesterol. So look, man, it's March Madness. This only happens once a year. Eat the wings, drink the beer, go to Buffalo Wild Wings, take a little stop at Wingstop, get some fries there. Hell, if you're in a big city, go find like a wing joint that is like original, not a chain restaurant. Go find your original wing joint, but you can never go wrong with Buffalo Wild Wings. And look, all I can tell you is this. March Madness is my favorite time of year. It coincides with spring break for me the first couple of days, so I'm looking forward to that. If you do get buffalo wings and you do get some cheese curds, all I can tell you is figure out your streaming situation. Make sure you can watch all the games and also figure out how you can get like an iPad. So if you're eating wings, like you're going to be on the toilet for like 20% of your day. But you don't want to miss the action, so you can have it in your hands while you're pooping. So figure it out. Figure out the streaming situation. But yes, Chris, eat wings, not four straight days, every damn day. If you get tired of the wings, put the wings on top of some lettuce. You got some salad, go for it.
I would say this. I was when the selection show happened on Sunday, and then on Monday when I saw FSU was playing Friday at 9:30, I did celebrate a little bit. I was like, awesome. It's not during the day where I would miss the game. But yeah, obviously I will not be watching the UFC card on Saturday. We'll watch it.
Can I just say that selection show was total buttholeness? Like that was an awful selection show. How do you ruin the selection show? How is that possible?
I don't understand the thought process in it. You know, just because like if you're a fan of a team on the bubble, if you're, you know, let's just say you are a fan of, I'm trying to think of a team that was in the early on in the alphabet that was on the bubble. Let's say Louisville, for instance. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's the only one I can think of off the top of my head. It was a bubble team that didn't get in. Like, once you get past all the schools with the letter L, like, why are you watching?
Hey, I tell you what, it's okay if people stop watching after 10 minutes. But you know what they should do? Show the bracket like it's a bracket. The whole alphabet thing was so confusing. You know, I had to, like, think about which teams are, you know, it pisses me off, Jason. The best part is you can go region by region and you just reveal the matchups. And they should do it in one break. As soon as the show starts, because the problem is this. You're not going to make or break your expected money. Like the expected money you're going to make for a year on ads. That's not going to be made or broken in a single hour broadcast.
Look, maybe an MMA producer came up with this idea and said, hey, we really know how to draw out a broadcast.
Oh my God! Yeah, you're right. Oh my God, you're so right.
That's the best part I love about going to regional MMA. Is you know it just goes boom, 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 boom. The fights just happen. You know,
you are doing a broadcast wrong if your viewer is watching your broadcast and thinking, "Oh, they're drawing this out to sell ad rates." Your viewer should not be thinking this. Your viewer should be thinking this is a good product, but no.
I think Darren Revell had a tweet about what CBS and Turner is paying for the tournament over the next 4 years. It's astronomical. I mean, it was like around $900 million a year. I'm like, but yeah, we can't pay athletes. Okay, sure.
Yeah, I feel like if you just divided $900 million over all the basketball players, like they would probably make a lot of money. Yeah. That's a lot of money, bro. And that's just for the championship. That's crazy. I mean, that'd be good for my school because, like, we don't make that much money. But we could make money off the, you know, the Blue Bloods. But, yeah, anyways. Yeah. I don't even know how that split up. Who's like, the super rich guy because of all that?
Well, allegedly, NCAA is a not-for-profit organization, allegedly.
Yeah.
I don't know how when you make $900 on a tournament that you could be a not-for-profit.
Bro, you're if you're the NCAA president, you sure as hell ain't living in low income housing. I tell you that much. The NCAA president, you freaking have like a freaking gate, you know, and like multiple vehicles, and you know other rich people stuff. Like you have the ability to just go to better restaurants than Buffalo Wild Wings, but they're really.
Look, this is one of my favorite sports weekends of the year, and we talked about this on last week's podcast. That's why it just. To me, what was an odd decision for the UFC to run an event this week. I think it would have made, and maybe you know the venue wasn't available last Saturday, but to me, it just I don't understand the situation because I gotta imagine you know when you look at this fight card, there's notable matchups on it, no question. I mean, the main event, and co-main event have implications at heavyweight and light heavyweight. But I got to imagine that, you know, for a lot of the UFC audience, you know, they're probably going to be taking in the NCAA tournament over the UFC card. But maybe because it's Fight Pass, there's not a huge. But and also maybe this is a case where the UFC kind of figures out is doing kind of a research study on their fans.
Yeah, yeah, it's like we're little rats. Just they're testing on us. I think this is almost like a live event that happens to be on TV. You know, maybe their focus is just sell some tickets in England, make a little bit of money there, and we'll broadcast it on Fight Pass. But there are two notable fights that a hardcore fan should seek out, at least. The main event and co-main event are really relevant to the rankings. And those are, you know, that it's almost like it's a two-fight card for most fans.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested to see how Tom Dukinwa bounces back, taking on Terrion Ware. Obviously, a huge matchup for Terrion Ware. You know, Leon Edwards, you know, can he continue that rise up the 170-pound rankings? When you look at that preliminary card, John Phillips making his UFC debut. I was watching his interview on Ariel's show on Monday. Really interesting kind of hearing the backstory of him taking on Charles Burr. Of course, had his time during Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series. Hakeem Duwadu on the prelims, a guy that anyone who followed the World Series of Fighting product, very exciting 145-pound fighter. Interested to see how he does. In terms of the rest of the card, you know, of course, it went through a change. Alex Reyes off this fight card due to injury. Stevie Ray back in the UFC. He takes on Cajun Johnson. Anything else really stick out to you about this event?
Yeah, nothing really, man. Again, I just think, honestly, you'll do yourself a favor just by watching the main card. And then keep an eye out for what happens on the prelims, because there are a lot of prelims, and this is a fight card where it's more like who's going to stand out amongst the prelim fighters, who's going to make that statement, who is going to be the guy or female fighter that we're going to talk about afterwards. Because usually when we have cards like this, the general cliche is they end up being really entertaining. So we'll watch the fights and we'll tell you what happened, but I can't really predict what's going to be the best thing on that prelim. But to me, the safe bet is for sure to tune into that main card. And fortunately, that broadcast will be a lot quicker than we're accustomed to on TV.
And then we don't have MMA for another 3 weeks.
I think we're just going to have to go and talk about Nick Newell again.
You know, that weekend, you look at April 6th, April 7th, was announced on Monday. James Gallagher out of the Bellator fight card. Benson Henderson versus Roger Huerta is now the main event. You talk about a matchup coming out of nowhere, you know, with that one. Then, of course, that Saturday night, Tony Ferguson, Khabib Nurmagomedov. Let's just pray that fight makes it. And UFC, just take my money.
Yep, 100%. I cannot wait for that fight card. That is, to me, the big-time fight card.
I tell you what, that's a great you know, maybe I'm wrong in saying great, but in my mind, it's a great, great five-fight main card for UFC 223.
It is, especially in the context of what we've gotten this year. What we've gotten this year, we've gotten a poo-poo platter of pay-per-view main cards, and we finally have, like, a normal meal, and now we can pretend like it's the best thing ever.
I mean, you got Rose and Ioana in the co-main, Calvin Kattar and Nato Moicano. Nice matchup there at 145 pounds. Chiesa versus Pettis, and Nai Quinta against Felder. I mean, you know, love that five-fight main card. Looking forward to that. I will definitely be sitting on my couch and, you know, forking over to $65 to DirecTV.
Damn right. You know it's a good card when we're like a few weeks out and we're already talking about it. That's how you know it's a freaking great card.
God, can we just tell Tony and Khabib stop training?
I know.
You guys are good. Just show up in Brooklyn and make weight. Let's actually see. God, this fight has been, what, 2 years in the making?
Yeah, we've had it made so many times in a row. I mean, we've had this fight, I think, closer than this point, and it's been canceled. So, knock on wood. I want to see this fight, and, you know, I just can't wait. I don't even want to think about it till it's, like, the week of the fight, just because I just – every time on Twitter, man, I'm just nervous about what's going to happen with this fight, because we have seen it time and again get canceled.
When you heard Benson Henderson, Roger Huerta, what went through your mind?
Roger Huerta. He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. I feel like that was his reputation for the longest time. What went through my mind – like what's going on with Roger Huerta lately. And I kind of did a quick Google, and, you know, not the most impressive resume, but, I guess that's the guy that's on Scott Coker's speed dial, and it's kind of crazy that Huerta is only 34 years old.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I looked at that and I was like, I just like thought he was older.
Yeah, it felt so long ago, and he was like having amazing fights with Clay Guida. In fact, it was 8 years ago that he had that fight with Clay Guida.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, so he must have been like 26 years old at the time. So, you know, he has two wins over Adrian Peng, and he has a disqualification victory over Haider Hassan. I don't know how that transpired.
It was illegal elbows that Haider landed to the back of his head. That's why there was a DQ there. You know, I'm sure there's probably some lightweights in Bellator that were probably upset with that fight booking. I'm sure there's probably a lot other lightweights that would have jumped at the opportunity to fight Benson Henderson. Unfortunately, we'll have to watch Benson Henderson on tape delay. Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, all I can say is this is a great fight for Benson Henderson.
Yeah, I like the matchmaking because it's two fighters who, you know, need to show what they've got left in the tank. But yeah, it's you know, that's one of those Bellator cards that I don't think there will be much buzz at all for it. Obviously, tape delay is going to hurt, but there wasn't a lot to it. James Gallagher, now the second fight he's pulled out of. First fight, it was due to a knee injury. This time, hand injury. He on his Instagram mentioned that it was a fractured hand, and he wanted to fight, but just could not get could not get medically cleared to fight there. But next week, 2 weeks, kind of a little bit of slow in MMA, but I'm sure that we will have something to talk about next week, Daniel.
Absolutely, it's a sport that keeps on giving, but at least we can talk about the fight card that's going to happen this week.
Of course,
we'll talk about it.
Exactly. And of course, we can. You can follow myself on Twitter at Jason_Floyd. You can follow Daniel on Twitter at DanielGalvonDGG. Of course, I will be calling the Shogun fights coming up on Saturday down in South Florida. Looking forward to that. And of course, if you're not subscribed to this podcast, we'd love for you to do that. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play. Just search The MMA Report. So that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of The MMA Report podcast, which comes out every Wednesday morning on RadioInfluence.com.
This is the Landry Football with Chris Landry. Quick fix on Radio Influence.
Part of the trade, as we're on quarterbacks, was the movement of Deshaun Kizer to Cleveland from Demaryius Randall. Listen, I understand it. This was the whole thing. Well, Hugh Jackson wanted Deshaun Kizer last year. Not so fast. You saw some good things in Deshaun Kizer, but that they did not have him rated. That was more of an analytics pick. And I think the need for a quarterback to add a young quarterback is something that he wanted, but if you had his choice, that would not have been the guy. If you look at the decision to move on from Deshaun, that had more to do with Hugh than the front office.
Chris Landry brings you Landry Football every week on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, RadioInfluence.com.